You're listening to Veracity Radio. James E. is a former U.S. Army chaplain who was subject to arrest, confinement, and charges of sedition, aiding the enemy, spying, espionage, and failure to obey a general order. The charges were later reduced and then dropped, but it raised the question about the U.S. attitude towards its own loyal service members, who were also Muslim, and whether the U.S. was capable of understanding a conflict it was in. Since his honorable discharge from the military, Yi has been a critic of the U.S. treatment of detainees, the treatment of the Quran by the U.S. military, and the treatment of service members who are Muslim. I spoke with Captain Yi about his experiences and his role in a panel discussion on torture for the Torture Awareness Month in Minnesota. We're joined here by James Yi. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And so, first off, let's talk a little bit about what's happening this Sunday, and then we're going to go into some background. You have an event this Sunday in Minnesota. Can you tell us about that panel?
I'm invited by a group called Tackling Torture from the Top. And as we know, June is Anti-Torture Month. And I've been for the last 2-3 years publicly speaking out against torture, mainly because of my role as the Muslim chaplain down in Guantanamo Bay, where I saw and witnessed and was aware of a tremendous amount of abuse that occurred to prisoners held in U.S. custody at this prison camp.
Let's go back a little bit. Let's introduce the audience to who you are, in case they weren't following the events of the last several years. You were born and raised in New Jersey, and you were born to a Lutheran family. Was your family much of a practicing family as far as religion?
I was born in Naperville, Illinois.
Okay.
I grew up in New Jersey.
Oh, I'm sorry, the other way around. Go ahead.
My mom raised all of the kids in my family Lutheran. Lutheran being one of the more liturgical Protestant denominations. And we went to church every Sunday as youngsters. We went to Sunday school, and we all at some point in our youth participated in the church youth group activities, and were all confirmed in the 8th grade according to Lutheran doctrine.
And so how did you make the progression from there to looking into Islam?
When I graduated West Point, I found myself one day in what you might call interfaith dialogue, and really, it was just a discussion with another college student about on each individual beliefs, and I was Christian. This person was studying Islam and asked me what I thought about, you know, just the basic idea of believing in one God without having to believe in this idea of the Trinity. And actually, that was something I rejected outright because I was Christian and was brought up and raised with the belief of the Trinity. But I was challenged, and when I was asked, you know, do I know anything about Islam, and when I said no, the question was, how could I judge something if I didn't know anything about it? And that made sense. So I went on my own, started reading about Islam, and I became intrigued by discovering that most of what Muslims believe were things that I myself as a Christian already believed. And I saw the vast commonality between Islam and Christianity. And when I converted to Islam, for me, it was a reconfirmation of my monotheistic faith in one God.
So in a way, it didn't feel like you had extended too far beyond your original roots.
You know what? When I first became Muslim, it wasn't any major life-changing event. It was just a reconfirmation of that belief in one God. But something that did very much inspire me not long after that was my first journey to Mecca when I was deployed as a U.S. soldier in the aftermath of the first Gulf War to Saudi Arabia. And I had the opportunity to go to Mecca only a few months after I converted to Islam, maybe 6 months or so after I converted to Islam. I was very much a new convert, and I was inspired by really seeing the vast display of diversity. I guess you can say it was a Malcolm X-like type experience
for me. Right, I was just thinking of Malcolm. When did you enlist in the military?
Well, I graduated from West Point.
Okay.
The United States Military Academy in 1990. I entered the academy in 1986, in July of 86. So that's when I actually first stepped into the military.
And what was your role before Guantanamo?
In my early career, I was an air defense artillery officer, a Patriot missiles fire control officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I would leave active duty in the in the early 90s, in June of 93. Mm-hmm. Was put into the inactive reserves, and then I would come back on active duty in January of 2001 as a Muslim chaplain. One of the things that I saw as a new convert to Islam, serving in Saudi Arabia in the aftermath of the First Gulf War, was the rapid increase of Muslim personnel within the ranks of our U.S. military. The First Gulf War brought a couple thousand Muslim converts. I'd heard maybe 5,000 or 7,000 U.S. soldiers converted to Islam as a result of serving in the region during the First Gulf War. But we didn't have a single Muslim chaplain during that time. And so I actually had hoped that one day maybe I would be the first.
Hey, what do you think the appeal was that would increase the enlistment role?
During the First Gulf War, under the first George Bush, mm-hmm. Bush father, there was actually a genuine coalition of forces fighting to oust Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi troops from Kuwait.
Okay.
You had several Muslim nations fighting alongside the U.S. forces. Very different from the Iraqi conflict that we see today.
Right.
You don't have a single Muslim nation that supports U.S. military action in Iraq today, and there's a stark contrast. Back then, you had much more of an open dialogue between Muslims, Muslims from other nations and armies,
right?
And today, where we see more of a hostility towards Islam.
And in that time, in the 90s, we also had the events with Bosnia. What are your thoughts on that period?
Well, yeah, that happened mostly under the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
I myself didn't take part directly in any of the Bosnian conflict. I do know a friend of mine who is also a Muslim chaplain in the U.S. Army. He worked with the refugees who were housed at Fort Dix in New Jersey.
Right. Well, there was, I know in the case of, for instance, the testimony from the man we call Abu Zubaydah, for instance, he was one of the many people who referred to the U.S. campaign in Bosnia as a favorable thing amongst Muslims because we had, in fact, defended the Muslims who were coming under attack. So I was curious how that was received. So let's move forward to an area that obviously where the world began to change. Now, you came back, you said, in January 2001?
January 2001, I reentered the ranks of active duty as a Muslim chaplain, correct?
Okay, and since September 11th had not happened yet, what was it about January 2001 that brought you back in?
I had left the military in 93, had gone on and pursued some individual studies of Islam, went to learn a little bit of the classical Arabic language so I can recite the Quran in its original form, and then I would meet up again years later in 99, late 2000, or early 2000, with a retired Marine who I had known, a Muslim Marine, and he would become the ecclesiastical endorser for Muslim chaplains, and then he recruited me back in the Army to be one of the first Muslim chaplains. I would come back on active duty then, that January 2001.
Well, obviously, later in that year, the world changed dramatically. Your role would change, obviously, shortly after. So if you came back in January 2001, can you, from your angle, tell us how things began to change in your role after September 11th, 2001, between there, and if you tell us when you first wound up going to Guantanamo Bay?
Right. Well, immediately following 9/11, I was approached by my battalion commander to educate our troops about Islam and the Muslim culture.
Okay.
This was done as a result of some personnel within our unit who were questioning the loyalty of a handful of Muslims that we had after 9/11.
Okay.
And so my commander wanted to address this immediately and asked if I would give a presentation to our entire unit about Islam and Muslim culture. And I answered the many questions that soldiers had about Islam. And many of them came away with a better understanding. And the next thing I knew it, the next thing you find is every commander on the base was then requesting my assistance to educate their troops. And I became well known on the base, on the installation. I became a point person for media requests regarding Islam and Muslims in the U.S. military. I began to receive enormous recognition from the highest levels of the Pentagon and the State Department. And I believe it was this recognition that landed me the position in Guantanamo Bay, that I was handpicked to serve as the Muslim chaplain for this now infamous prison camp on the island of Cuba.
And when did you first arrive in Guantanamo Bay?
I got to Guantanamo Bay in November of 2002, just as Major General Jeffrey Miller took over the command.
Okay.
Major General Jeffrey Miller now is known for the one who brought the harsh interrogation practices of Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib,
right,
leading to the horrendous abuse and humiliation of prisoners in Iraq.
So when you arrived at Gitmo, Jeffrey Miller was in charge already?
He took command virtually the day that I arrived there.
Do you remember who was in charge before him?
Yeah, you had General Dunleavy.
Okay.
Was a two-star, was heading up the intelligence operation. And then you had another general, a Marine general, who was there at the very early start. And then there was another general also, who was from part of the Rhode Island National Guard.
Okay. So Jeffrey Miller, though, basically arrived at the same timing as you. How did the command hold your position once they started filling the detention camp up? Before this allegation of documents and such, what was the treatment and the dialogue between you and the command on base at the time?
Well, I was the chaplain assigned to the prison camp, and you know, I would learn that my role was to be an advisor on religion.
Okay.
How the religious practices of these Muslim prisoners affected the detention operation.
Mm-hmm.
As well as being a chaplain to the prisoners. And in that role as a chaplain, I had pretty much unfettered access, unescorted access and authorization to the prison cell blocks, and met with prisoners on a daily basis trying to address their concerns.
After about a year, I guess it would be, say, if you were there in November 2002, just under a year, on September 10th, you were arrested as you were coming into Jacksonville, Florida. Can you tell us the circumstances of that arrest? And then if you lay out what factually is correct about that and what is factually disputed about that. In other words, what were you accused of? How much of that is true? And then how much of that is simply manufactured?
Well, basically what happened was, after serving 10 months in Guantanamo,
okay,
after receiving awards, after receiving a stellar officer evaluation report, I received R&R, rest relaxation. I got 2 weeks off to go home, see my family, knowing that after 2 weeks, I would have to return back to Guantanamo, finish two more months, and that would be a full year of duty at Guantanamo.
Okay.
I got on a plane from Guantanamo to Florida, and I had a connecting flight from Jacksonville, Florida to Seattle, but I never made that connecting flight as I was stopped by immigration officers, customs officials who searched my bags, and they would make these spurious claims that I was carrying what they called suspicious documents. Mm-hmm. In an instant, there were intelligence officers on the scene. Counterintelligence, NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigators, FBI was there, and they would then say that I was carrying classified documents. They got an arrest warrant. They would throw me in prison, And next thing I know, I'm being accused of being this terrorist spy. They wanted to levy charges of espionage, spying, aiding the enemy. And they would even threaten me with the death penalty.
Is there any of that that's true? Did you have information that was there that simply wasn't classified? Or what was the what points of that were intersected with truth and then just maybe overblown? Or is there any truth to that?
Well, for one, I'm not a terrorist spy like they portrayed and characterized me as. I'm a patriotic American, a graduate of West Point, and I'm from a family that is deeply rooted in the military.
Uh-huh.
You know, my younger brother is a West Point graduate who just served his second reserve tour in the Middle East.
Right.
My other brother is an active duty Army physician serving Fort Hood in Texas. Mm-hmm. And my father, who is also a U.S.-born Chinese-American citizen, served in the Army when he was drafted during World War II. So that's the first truth.
Okay.
Is that I'm not a terrorist spy, but actually I'm a patriotic American.
Okay.
This whole idea about what information was I carrying, most of what I had was research that I was doing for my master's degree course on the Middle East. I was enrolled at the time in a master's program of international relations, and while I was down at Guantanamo, I was doing research to complete a final project for that course. I've since completed that program and now do have a master's in international relations.
But a lot of what drew
some suspicions was what was all this information about the Middle East. FBI agents would question me about this information about the Syrian president, who was the topic of my research paper. A lot of claims were made later that I had sensitive information that couldn't be disclosed, and therefore that's why the charges were dropped and never went to trial.
So
the only information I think that is relevant that I had, which they consider sensitive, is my own personal documentation of specific abuses
mm-hmm.
that occurred in Guantanamo to prisoners. And the military would consider that sensitive because they want to cover that stuff up.
Right.
They want to cover up the fact that prisoners were subjected to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, as well as, gross violations of integrity.
If you were arrested on September 10th and you were basically the charges were dropped, and I'm looking at the date, actually it's a very ironic date, March 19th, which is 1 year after the head strike on Iraq, but that's a fairly short period of time for them to go from really ratcheting it up against you to dropping charges. That's a might seem a long time to you at the time, I'm sure, but they finally dropped the charges in March 19th, 2004.
I think it was pretty clear to everyone, even within the highest ranks of the military, in the government, that you know I was not this terrorist spy like I was being characterized by the media, based on information that was being leaked to them from the military. But questions started being asked when I was thrown in prison.
Right.
Like, who is this, you know, Captain James Yee? And when people started doing their research and looking up my profile online and seeing, you know, that I had, you know, a flawless military record, that I was someone who, after 9/11, publicly stated that those who carried out the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon had to be brought to justice,
mm-hmm.
whether they were Muslim or whether they weren't Muslim. So when people, those in the media, started researching who I was, it just didn't make sense. And, you know, people in Congress got very concerned about, you know, my case. And when the charges were dropped, several members of Congress, specifically those who were on the House Armed Service Committee, as well as on the Senate Armed Service Committee, rendered support to me and demanded from Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense at the time, as well as from the Inspector General of the Department of Defense, to answer questions as to why was I treated in this manner and how did this all happen.
Now, this wasn't the end of pressure on you, though. After this event, did you receive more harassment and or accusations or pressure?
Well, I was cleared of every accusation, every charge that was levied against me. I was sent back, reinstated as a chaplain to serve our soldiers. And it wasn't long before I found that I was still under scrutiny. I was essentially gagged. I was warned as a military officer not to speak out about how I was treated and not to say anything critical of the Department of the Army or the Department of the Defense, and that if I did, I would be sitting back in a prison cell. I didn't like how I was being treated even after I was cleared. So I tendered my resignation. I received an honorable discharge in January of 2005, and when I separated, I received a second U.S. Army Commendation Medal for exceptionally meritorious service. And as soon as I got out of the military, I went right to work and decided that I would document my entire experience in the military in Guantanamo Bay and expose much of what really went on inside this prison camp.
Now, I hope you'll send me a copy of your book. I'd love to read it so we can talk further about it. But this resulted in the book you published called For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. Can you tell us a little bit about what you cover in your book?
I opened my experience with, you know, the day I was arrested from Guantanamo Bay. I briefly talk about a little bit of my personal biography, mm-hmm. being born in America to a Chinese American family, growing up in the United States, having the all-American childhood. Going to West Point, graduating from the academy, and then my journey to Islam, how I converted, and then going on to become a Muslim chaplain. And then my story rolls into the attacks of 9/11 and how I was then placed in that assignment, Guantanamo Bay, and my experience in Guantanamo and working with prisoners and trying to fight against the torture and abuse that was being handed down, perhaps at the encouragement of top-level White House personnel during that time.
I want to talk a little bit more specifically about Jeffrey Miller. As you pointed out, he was in charge of the Abu Ghraib prison at the timing of the abuses, and then he had his role at Guantanamo. Could you characterize his overall attitude towards the detainees, and how did that trickle through the ranks?
General Miller was a very overbearing commander. In my view, he had a lot of hostility towards Muslims. What I found very astounding was that in Guantanamo Bay, there was allowance for dietary religious accommodation to the Muslim prisoners. All of the meals that were served were prepared according to Muslim Islamic dietary guidelines. All the meat was properly slaughtered, known as halal, which is a concept similar to kosher in the Jewish faith. This was allowed and permitted by the commander for the Muslim prisoners. But when Muslim military service personnel, when U.S. citizens, U.S. Muslims who were serving the U.S. Army requested religious accommodation for dietary accommodation, Major General Jeffrey Miller denied those requests. These requests were made with my support, with support of U.S. Army regulations, which allows for religious accommodations. I was astounded that Major Miller would deny and not support the troops in something like this, even when the prisoners had this accommodation. To me, that's an indication of how he viewed Muslims and how he treated Muslims, and that perhaps he only allowed it for the prisoners because it might have been a good PR move for the command.
In our discussions over the past few weeks with other former military personnel, including interrogator Matthew Alexander, including SEER instructor Malcolm Nance, we have discussed the strategic need to be very clear about the Islamic culture and to be able to tell the difference between people who are Muslim and people who are actually perverting Islam for their own, as Malcolm refers to, cultish gains. From your perspective, do you think that the United States has begun, at least the military side, do you think they've begun to finally tune in to the reality that, you know, launching a war on a billion plus Muslims is strategically ignorant, and that they really need to focus, one, on a legitimate target, and two, they need to reform the American dialogue about the conflict? Or do you see any really changes about the same?
Well, with the new administration, with the Obama administration, I have seen some positive moves on the part of the president to improve outreach to the Muslim world. I mean, when he first gave his, when President Obama gave his first televised public interview, it was to an Arab satellite channel known as Al Arabiya. He gave a major historic speech last year in Cairo. He's brought some prominent Muslims, American Muslims, into his inner circle, his cabinet. He recently appointed a well-known American Muslim to the envoy to the OIC, the Organization of the Islamic Conference. So he has done a lot of outreach, but in terms of hard actions to make any changes in U.S. foreign policy, we have yet to see it. I mean, he promised to close Guantanamo. That hasn't happened. He promised to bring the troops home. We haven't seen that yet, but instead he's surged Afghanistan. These things, I think, are also working to question whether or not President Obama has really made significant changes with regard to, you know, our relations with the Muslim world. And I think many, many people around the world, many in the Muslim world have already written Obama off as someone who hasn't made the changes that he's promised.
In light of the changes we just saw today with the resignation of Stanley McChrystal, it makes us really take a look at the inner circle, the top command. And I have been wondering for a long time, for the last maybe year or so, since I began to think that, you know, Obama was not going to fulfill some of these promises. Do you think there's a chance, just from your vantage point, I know this is kind of guessing and on both of our behalf, but do you think there's a vantage point where these top brass wind up in the White House for a consultation? Obama may want to do something, and then just by virtue of the amount of brass standing in front of him, as one person said, more brass than the best college bands, do you think he basically gets put in a position where he cannot assert a backbone position where he says, this is where we're going to go? Do you think those men sit him down and say, look, you know, I'm beg to differ with you, Mr. President, but we really need to keep this open. Give us more time. How do you think that works? I mean, from your vantage point, how do you think that happens at the top?
You know, well, one of the things that I'm looking at right now with this whole General McChrystal situation is, where does this fall within the big picture? I think what has just happened with General McChrystal and him publicly ridiculing people in the White House and his staff criticizing, you know, the president, the commander-in-chief, to me, this is an indication that leadership within our U.S. military has really eroded. I mean, every military officer goes through military science classes and leadership training, and we understand that there's a civilian control of the military. And we, as military officers, know that, okay, while we carry out the mission, we still fall subordinate to civilian leadership. That's the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense, President. And to see a high-ranking general basically, go against that whole idea that, you know, that concept, and really show the world that, you know, he believes that he is someone who he thinks should be running the military, in my view, is an indication that our top leadership in the military today has deteriorated. I think the previous administration did a very, very good job of getting rid of those military leaders who were top-notch. You know, people like General Shinseki, for example, who chief staff of the Army was railroaded out by Rumsfeld and his crew. It was nice to see that the general was given a secretary cabinet position as Secretary of Veterans Affairs under the Obama administration. But I think the previous administration did a pretty good job of getting rid of those generals, those top brass who really knew what they were doing.
Anthony Zinni comes to mind also. You have thoughts on Anthony Zinni, General Zinni?
No particular comments on...
Okay. He's been very critical of the previous administration.
Basically, anyone who was rendering sincere advice that, you know, we now can look back and say, hey, that most of that advice was good advice, even though it was critical of what President Bush or Vice President Cheney or Rumsfeld, what they wanted, those people were all railroaded out.
One of the things that we will explore in our show in the coming weeks will be discussion of some of these hierarchical principles, and we will be discussing Master Sun Tzu's teachings about retaining order from the top down, but especially about the role of the civilian order and the role of the military order and how they intersect. In the case of the Bush administration, as an example, I know that Master Sun Tzu would refer to basically lazy and frivolous civilian leadership, throwing military around to do different things, at which point basically the morale falls dramatically short because, of course, the military has no effective goal in mind. They're just being expended. So that's one of the things we saw under the Bush administration. And I think we should be looking at in the future. I want to talk specifically about a few, you know, not necessarily detainees by name, but just classes of detainees. And now that we see some of the prosecutions, we're going to see maybe 30 something folks, I believe. Is that the number you've heard? Have you been following that?
Yeah, something like that.
30-ish or so.
You know, I've been a little bit disappointed that President Obama has seemingly went back to using the military commissions that were crafted under the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
He had promised to essentially scrap the military commissions and expressed his support that, you know, our Constitution and federal courts are more than adequate to try terror suspects or crimes of terrorism. I'm not someone who supports the military commissions whatsoever.
Do you think can you give us an example where you think military commissions, just so we can understand where the line might be, can you give us an example where you believe military commissions are appropriate? Not necessarily with any particular scenario we have now, but just in the ideal world, what would the perfect reason for using a military commission be?
Right now, there's no need for them.
Okay.
Military commissions are essentially set up to have a lower legal standard to be able to convict someone of a war crime.
Okay.
To me, I think that hurts the reputation of the United States as a country that follows the rule of law. There are things within the military commission system that are not allowable, that are not acceptable in any fair, open, just court here in the United States. I mean, things like hearsay, things like evidence being gained through coercive or torture could be permitted in some of these military commissions.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real full process to appeal. You could only appeal the military commission's process and not the conviction itself. Things like this, from my understanding.
Okay.
I'm in no way a military law expert, but...
But you have a sense of honor and code that at least as a soldier would tell you this is maybe the appropriate timing for such an event, and the rest of the time, no. Would that be fair?
Yeah, and to me, just in general, military law, I mean, is very biased.
In favor of the military.
Even under the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which
right.
is set up to put U.S. service members on trial if they were to commit a crime, because the juries are military members themselves. I mean, a terror suspect who's put in front of a military jury is almost assured to be convicted just because of the bias. One of the things that I've seen in keeping an eye on soldiers who have committed atrocities in the combat zone, that many of their colleagues acquit them of a potential execution type style murder of a civilian. Their colleagues in the military, are very ready to acquit someone of something which is just a gross crime because of the bias in the military. So it works
right.
both ways.
Well, one of the things we'd like to talk about in the future also, we're going to bring people on to talk about the consequences of positive bias. In the case of, for instance, the BP disaster now, I get frequent emails from people in the oil industry that try to explain their industry to me as if that's going to change my not in the industry view. same thing with the military. Whenever I'm looking at a CSRT on a detainee and I look at the language being used with them, it's a very assumptive, already charged language. It's already laden with accusations in the words themselves. So let's look a little bit at the treatment of the detainees and a few kind of overarching themes. Number one, having read some of the CSRTs and followed not as well as someone like Andy Worthington, but I've looked into some of their cases, it strikes me that there were a few people who said basically, yes, I was involved in this. I did this. I'm a warrior, tough. American can go to hell. And I don't necessarily see a crime against the U.S. They're just basically not interested in playing our ball. Then next to them will be someone who claims to have come from Yemen to Afghanistan on missionary work. Now, I want to stop there for a moment because – that was a common theme, actually, in many of the first CSRTs I read, for instance, in what we call the Dirty 30, the first 30 detainees apprehended on December 15th, 2001, brought there. Many of them had the same story, that they were missionaries coming from Yemen, going to Afghanistan, and the people interviewing them completely talked with disbelief, like, how could you be a missionary going to Yemen? Now, as a person growing up in a Judeo-Christian society, I know plenty of Christian missionaries that have gone to Afghanistan and Pakistan, no big deal. So I don't know why it would strike anyone, unless they had a prejudice in the conversation, to think that a Muslim wouldn't be there acting as a missionary for Islam, especially since no one in the area will be speaking Arabic, and you would probably want someone who's a native Arabic speaker to be teaching you. So knowing a little bit of these nuances, can you tell us without betraying a confidence that was given you in your role, can you tell us a little bit about the dialogues you may have had with some of the prisoners? And did you run across guys that, even from where you were sitting, this guy, he probably did something pretty bad. And then you probably talked to someone else who clearly was innocent and shouldn't be there in the first place. Can you share a view on that a little bit with us?
I would say that the vast, vast majority of the prisoners in Guantanamo were innocent of any crimes.
Right.
I would say that when I was in Guantanamo in November of 2002 through September of 2003, there wasn't a single person in Guantanamo being held that could be in any way directly tied to 9/11. That just was not possible. And I say that because if our government had captured anyone who they suspected of being involved with 9/11, they weren't brought to Guantanamo.
They were black sided.
They were put in a CIA black site.
Right.
So the people in Guantanamo had nothing to do with 9/11. I will also say that if you didn't hate America before you were in Guantanamo, after Guantanamo, you surely hate America now because of the way they were treated, how they were abused. And many, I would say many of the prisoners, you know, had you know, no necessarily negative attitudes towards America, but after being wrongfully thrown in prison and tortured and abused, you know, they came out, you know, hating America.
Did you appeal to anyone in that position? If they shared that with you, was there any part of you that just tried to appeal beyond those lines and just say, you know, human to human, you know, I'm sorry, or what would that do to you?
I mean, for me, I mean, I think one of the challenges I had was dialoguing with some of the prisoners who found it difficult for another Muslim who would be willing to serve in the U.S. military, knowing that a great part of U.S. military action is in Muslim countries and against Muslim nations.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty challenging, dialoguing with prisoners on that idea.
And do you think it would be fair to say, at least, if you kept the parameters to the last 8 years, in other words, if you stopped, which I don't really want to do, but if you stopped in January 20th last year, in the Bush administration alone, would you say it was fair if someone said the United States was trying to launch an attack on Islam? Would you say if you could even quantify a percentage of that truth into the total campaign, would you say there's a little bit of truth in that?
I'm not sure what you're asking here.
Okay. If I look at the rhetoric from the elected officials, and if I look at some of the consequential rhetoric that we find in soldiers, I could easily make a case that America was going against Islam itself. And the reason why I would be able to make that is that I can tune in nightly to Fox News. I can tune into David Horowitz. I can listen to people like, you know, Joe Lieberman. And they have like one view, it seems like, if you listen to them long enough, that basically we're at war with Islam. And that narrative can be used overseas very easily. So it seems to me it would be a fair characterization that at least in the last 8 years that there is some truth to saying that the U.S. was at war with Islam. That might not have been the right choice to go to war with Islam, but would you say there's any truth to that, or am I just heavy-handing that?
Well, I would say that certainly there are many talking heads. There are many people who view this idea that there's this clash of civilizations between the West and Islam, and you want to make this case that, you know, that you know, the Western civilization is at war with Islamic civilization. But in my view, there's no need for any conflict. I mean, I'm an American and I'm a Muslim, and you know, my identity of my American identity and my Muslim identity actually complement and supplement each other.
Right.
The values that you find embodied in the Quran are essentially the same values you find embodied in the U.S. Constitution. I mean, we're talking about religious freedom, equality, justice, tolerance, you know, these types of things. But there are people who are looking to profit from war. And at this particular time, people want to spew this type of hatred towards Islam in order to ratchet up more and more military conflict, military action against Muslim nations.
In our conversation 2 weeks ago, Malcolm Nance and I talked about his book, An End to Al-Qaeda, and he basically says, as part of what he calls Operation Circuit Breaker, that you have to really root out these he didn't use the word apostates, but I will use the word apostates. You have to root these people out who really have nothing to do with Islam in the end. If you actually assess the made-up theology. First off, would you agree with his assessment that the extremist factions going under the name Al-Qaeda, or at least assigned the name Al-Qaeda, would you say that those groups are not, in fact, Islamic? They're just kind of co-opting the name of the religion?
Every religion has people who go outside the bounds of what is acceptable.
Right.
And there are many, many groups today that are doing things which are very un-Islamic. And killing civilians is something that is not acceptable in Islam.
So would a proper strategy, and he's not the only one. There was also a man who is a reformed, I forget his name, but I caught him. There was a 60 Minutes piece called The Narrative, and he basically had the same premise, which is that there is a narrative in the Islamic world that America is at war with Islam, and that this is not really true, that it, in fact America is at war with a isolated set of extremists who cloak themselves in Islam, and that it's very important for Muslims to know the difference. To espouse the difference and not be caught up in that. Would you say that's a legitimate plan to clarify what is, for lack of a better word, orthodox Islam? Go ahead.
I would still say that there is still a lot of bigotry against Islam.
Sure.
You might not necessarily call that war, but even within our own society, you find people discriminating against people because they are Muslim. That's wrong.
Right.
When Muslims are denied jobs, when they're denied housing, when they're denied when their places of worship are being vandalized and firebombed, you don't have to call it a war, but this is bigotry. And
right.
there are people who harbor very un-American attitudes when they do this. I mean, this is not what America is about. American values accepts people of all different races, of all different religions, faiths and creeds.
You're listening to Veracity Radio. We're spending time here with Captain James Yee, and I want to ask a little bit about the follow-up to your case and where things stand now. First off, you have a website, justiceforyee.com, and do you have ongoing legal expenses due to your interaction with the government at the time?
Well, at this time, I don't have any ongoing legal expenses. I've received an enormous amount of support,
good
donations from, good-hearted Americans within the Muslim community, within the Asian American community, within the communities of conscience, all across the country, and my legal expenses to date now have been paid off.
And tell us about ongoing campaigns, things that you really want to see in very focused fashion. What are some tangible goals we would like to see related to these topics of torture, Guantanamo, the administration? Can you name a few perceivable goals?
I would love to see Guantanamo closed, not tomorrow, but today.
Mm-hmm.
Colin Powell himself said that if it was up to him, he wouldn't close Guantanamo tomorrow. He would close it this afternoon. I would like to see Guantanamo closed, and I hope President Obama will do that. I also would like to see the military commission scrapped, that people who are going to be tried by the U.S. government for terrorist crimes be tried in a federal court. And federal courts have stood, the test of time with regard to even crimes of terrorism. I mean, we've had several trials involving terrorism that mm-hmm. have been very successful. So I would like to see the military commission scrapped. I would like to see a continued education of of the American people and the people of the West of Islam and the Muslim culture, in hopes that one day that Muslims will be seen as people who have made huge, you know, contributions not only to our country but to history, and that Islam has a lot to offer our nation with regard to good.
And what about prosecution from the lowest level soldiers who were simply guards, all the way up to, let's say, the Vice President of the United States at the time and the President of at the time? What do you think would be the use of formal prosecutions for these officials, especially the higher up officials?
Sure, if prosecutions are warranted, sure, they must be carried out. But before we get to prosecutions, sure, we should investigate. We should look at exactly what has been done. Have crimes been committed? Have laws been violated? That should be investigated. And you know, if we have the information that points to this occurrence, sure, that people need to be prosecuted. To date, no one really has been held accountable for Guantanamo and the abuses that have occurred in Guantanamo. And
even at the low level, have we had convictions of low-level guards?
No, I don't know of, even at the lower level, anyone really been being held accountable for gross abuses at Guantanamo.
But are you aware of at least events that should have resulted in such?
I believe we need to look a lot closer at what has gone on and do more independent investigations.
Right.
Internal investigations seem to clear themselves of any wrongdoing.
Right.
Even Major General Jeffrey Miller was recommended by U.S. Southern Command for reprimand. But yet,
okay,
the U.S. Army Inspector General decided that punishment wasn't warranted.
I know you weren't there at the time, but in around June of 2006, three detainees supposedly killed themselves as what was cynically described as asymmetric warfare. Have you looked at that case, and have you read the follow up that Scott Horton did with a sergeant who was on site?
Yeah, I did read the article in Harper's Magazine, and actually have spoken directly to that particular sergeant.
Oh, okay.
It's very interesting. You know, the facts of this case, and it's very possible that something much more evil has been covered up.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to look harder at really what happened to those individuals who supposedly committed suicide.
And again, that would be speculation, but at least I would say qualified speculation, especially if you've personally spoken with the sergeant and you've worked on site. So you have a sense at least of the prisoners' mindsets. Does it make sense to you that three Muslims would commit suicide in there like that?
I will tell you that many of the prisoners did mentally deteriorate from being caged like animals inside Guantanamo.
Sure.
There was a separate ward, you might call it, a prison cell block that was converted into a psych ward. When I was in Guantanamo, there was a 17-person psychiatric team because of the mental deterioration that occurred to prisoners from being, you know, caged up Guantanamo and subjected to enormous amount of abuse. So suicide is something that was a huge, you know, problem in Guantanamo. There were hundreds of suicide attempts that occurred when I was there.
Okay.
One of the things the military tried to do in covering that up was change the terminology and refer to these incidences as individual self-harm attempts. So when a journalist might ask, you know, how many suicide attempts, you know, they had a very, very small number that they would quote, because they classified most of these suicide attempts as self-harm. You know, this is, to me, a spin that they put on in order to cover up reality.
There are very few organizations who can pop out a euphemism faster than the U.S. military.
It's possible that, you know, prisoners did commit suicide, but at the same time, when we look at some of the the facts of this particular incident, it's also possible to question whether or not these individuals committed suicide based on the particular individuals of this case and you know, who they were and the likelihood of whether or not these particular individuals were ones who would be inclined to take their own lives.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us, and I hope you will come back and tell us a little bit more about the progress in the United States of people understanding Islam. In the time, we'll leave this as a final thought. In the time since you've gone public to discuss these things and given lectures, what would you say is the general reception you get when you go across the country to give a lecture and you talk about these issues? How are you received?
Overwhelmingly positive. Overwhelmingly positive. And especially on the college campuses, I get many, many questions afterwards from energetic college students who want to know what can they do to make a difference. And a lot of them are learning for the first time what's going on in Guantanamo or what has gone on in Guantanamo. And you know, it's been inspiring for me to help help shape the ideas of future leaders.
I think it's a very important role that you'll serve there. Well, thank you for joining us, brother, and we hope you'll come back.
Great. It's been my pleasure. We'll do it again sometime.
All the best to you and your family.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to Veracity Radio.